Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Celebration Studies, a special series from the New Books Network. I'm Isabel Machado, and I'll be your host for this episode. And today, I am just so happy, excited to talk to meu amigo, Dr. Miguel Valério, about Sovereign Joy, Afro-Mexican Kings and Queens, 1539 to 1640, that was published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. Sovereign Joy explores the performance of festive Black kings and queens among Afro-Mexicans between 1539 and 1640. It illustrates how the first African and Afro-Creole people in colonial Mexico transformed their ancestral culture into a shared identity among Afro-Mexicans, with particular focus on how public festival participation expressed their culture and subjectivities, as well as redefined their colonial condition and social standing. As the book beautifully shows, through performance, Afro-Mexicans affirm their being, the sovereignty of joy and the joy of sovereignty. Dr. Miguel Valério is assistant professor of Spanish at Washington University in St. Louis. He's a scholar of the African diaspora in the Iberian world and teaches courses in Afro-colonial culture and contemporary Afro-Latin American literature and culture. His research has focused on Black Catholic brotherhoods or confraternities and Afro-Creole festive practices in colonial Latin America, especially Mexico and Brazil. His work has been published in several academic journals, and he's also the co-editor of Indigenous and Black Confraternities in Colonial Latin America, Negotiating Status Through Religious Practices. Miguel, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you, Isabel. It's a pleasure to be here with you, a dear friend.
Now, I have so many questions about your book that I think we'll have to continue this at some other time, hopefully over some good food and drinks.
Yes. In Salvador.
Yes, hopefully Salvador or any other sunny part of the world.
Yes.
But let's begin, as I usually do with these interviews. I'll start by asking you to share with us your book's origin story.
It was straightforward. I was at a conference this weekend, and I was asking people their origin story. And this book has a straightforward origin story. I was taking a class. The person who would end up being my dissertation advisor, Lisa Void, was writing her own book on festivals in South American colonial mining towns. And she developed a course on colonial cities and festivals. And we were reading Bernal Díaz del Castillo description of that festival in Mexico City that I analyzed in chapter one. And I was reading the text and I came across the reference to the Black kings and queens in that festival. And it just piqued my curiosity. I had never seen anything like that in all my years of studies. And so I went to class with questions, and I then began to write a paper doing research for the paper. The paper was very well received. It won a prize, and I began looking for more examples of this in Mexico, where I discovered that it had not been studied. So it has been studied, as you very well know, in Brazil. This is a very well studied tradition, and Peru, Buenos Aires, Panama, to a lesser extent, and even Cuba, but no one had has studied it in Mexico. And I found all these examples in Mexico that, as you noted in some comments, it puts Mexico at the center of the formation of the Black Atlantic very early on, because these are the first example that we have of this tradition in the Americas, and they're appearing in Mexico, a place that is not normally thought as an important site of the development of Afro-Latin American history and culture.
Yes. So tell me, how did you decide and why did you decide to investigate this particular time frame?
So that also was kind of given to me. The first example that I found was 1539, which is the example study in chapter one. And then the last example that I found was 1640. So that when I was a kid, I had this book that I have since lost and have not been able to find, which was called 101 Poems. And the idea is that if 100 is a perfect number, 101 is more than a perfect number. In any event, besides that personal connection, it seems to have been given to me to have that 101 become something permanent for me, in the way that these festivals were given to me. So that 1640 was the last example that I found of a text describing Afro-Mexican festive practices. Although I look hard and wide for other examples, and in the conclusion, I deal a little bit with one of the only other texts that makes a very minor mention to Mexicans engaging in festive traditions, but it's nothing compared to those four examples that I found in those 101 years. But it's also significant that it ends in 1640, because that's the end of the Iberian Union, and that's also the end of the importation of Central Africans to Mexico. So that between 1580 and 1640 is a time where the largest number of people of African descent are brought to Mexico, and a tradition that is linked to Central Africa, and is also most of them are coming from Central Africa that are being brought to Mexico at that time, and then that ends in 1640 as well. So it's also historically significant that it ends there.
Yes. And I will ask you both about these Afro-Mexicans in that period, and about, you know, this question of why the story ends here in a minute. But I wanted to, let's open the book, right? Let's start by the gorgeous cover and by this title. I think I mentioned to you that your book had me at the title. So I want us to unpack this a bit, because this is not only, you know, an important contribution that your book is making, but you are also dialoguing with this exciting new body of scholarship on decolonial joy that you reference in your book. So first, how do you define sovereignty?
So in the book, I have identified two types of sovereignty. One is the communal sovereignty that the people staging these performances, they belong to confraternities, to brotherhoods. And as confraternities and brotherhoods, they have this communal sovereignty in the sense that for Black communities, this was the only safety net. And they had autonomy in setting their charitable as well as their cultural priorities. That although blacks were prosecuted in Mexico for this tradition, they insisted on performing with this tradition. And so there you have a communal sovereignty, and then what I call discursive sovereignty, which is the sovereignty that is staged in the performance itself, right? It is a symbolic sovereignty. It has huge political implications, especially in the context of Mexico, which is the only place where blacks were killed by the state for their festive traditions. And so staging these performances in this world is so powerful. And there is also a discursive sovereignty by appearing with royalty, with sovereignty, that expresses this communal sovereignty and this discursive sovereignty about the way I define it is the stories that we allow to tell ourselves about ourselves, right? That we tell ourselves and others about what we are. And here, they tell a very powerful story about not being helpless individuals, but rather being a powerful collective that has sovereignty in their community and also can stage these powerful expression of Black power, Black joy also.
Yes, then let's talk joy. Tell me about joyful defiance. I've mentioned this to you before, but this is a concept that resonated with me even before I had a name for it or a clear definition. As I told you, I wish I had your book when I was writing mine, because I'm particularly interested in this idea that, as you write here, to study joy is not to forget pain.
Right. So that in the Black experience in the last 500 years, of course, the larger story or the story that is at the forefront in most of the time is a story of slavery and all its violence. So we don't forget that that's part of the story. But there is also not to see the whole story as Black people saw it themselves, right? So that I began the book with a preface about the summer of George Floyd and people marching and dancing in the street. They were claiming Black Lives Matters in a joyful way, right? So that these expressions of joy are an expression that Black Lives Matters is a joyful defiance, right? A world that seeks to impose a sort of social death. We joyfully defy that, not to have joy, just being joyful. It's a defiance of that cosmology, of that cosmogony, of that will of that way of being, that way of the world of working, that is defined just by being joyful. And we see that throughout the history of the Black experience. And of course, we see it here in Mexico, especially when these Afro-Mexicans are performing after or in the middle of political turmoils, as in 1612, when the Afro-Mexicans who elected kings and queens were first exiled or sold out, and then eventually some were executed by the state.
Yes, and I think the framework that you establish here will be, used and very useful to people who are looking at very different topics. As I'm studying a very different time and place, and these ideas really resonated with me. But let's talk about sources now. What kinds of sources allow you to tell these stories? How do you find them? You already sort of mentioned the material that you found when you were as a student. And tell me about this diasporic approach that you employ in the book that I found really interesting.
Yeah, so the sources, I found three festival accounts that are straight out festival accounts. Chapter 4 is the festival account that is more independent, right? The other festival accounts that describe in one sentence or three or four paragraphs Black performance, whereas chapter 4 is the only festival accounts and one of the few colonial texts that is dedicated in its entirety to a Black topic. But then I also found archival sources that dealt especially with the with accusing or conflating with a purposeful and mischaracterization and conflating of festive Black kings and queens with rebellion, with revolt, with maroonage, and these sources. And so especially the archival sources had been studied before, and there are two trends. A trend in Latin America takes them at face value. The trend in the U.S. Is critical, reads them critically. But no one had looked at those archival sources and said, what if what is going on here is part of this larger festive traditions? Because they didn't have the straight-out festive accounts that to counter those archival sources with. But the sources that I found for Mexico were seven sources. They were, in some instances, very short. I mean, Dia del Castillo is one sentence. The other one is three paragraphs. The archival sources are 3 to 4 pages. So very short sources. And Mexico, the practice in Mexico doesn't make any sense without looking at the broader, right? And its connection to the broader African diaspora. So this is when I developed this diasporic framework because, as I do in Chapter 1, comparing something that happened in that is described as Mexico City in 1539 and then in Brazil in 1762, there are so many similarities, right, that we see that we're dealing here with the same tradition. And then when it came to the music, it was also impossible to make sense of the music that accompanied these performances without casting this wide diasporic net to look at the kind of musics that were part of this performance.
Yes, yes. And again, it helped me understand so much better other festive practices that I was looking at when you described this approach. So that was incredibly helpful for me. And you were talking about this a little bit, right? How you place Mexico City as, quote, a central site of the birth of the Black Atlantic and the cultural transformation set in motion by imperial expansion, or as a central site of the Black Atlantic. And I was born and raised in Bahia, Brazil, and I lived in northern Mexico for a while, where Black experiences were practically invisible for me, right? So as somebody who comes from Bahia, goes to northern Mexico. So I was surprised to see those descriptions. Can you paint for us a picture then of the lives and experiences of Afro-descendants in Mexico in this period? It's such a vivid, beautiful, live image that you paint in your book that I honestly was not expecting.
So in this time, we have in Mexico City, somewhere from 20,000 to maybe 40,000 people of African descent. There is a map in the book that was done just of the residences of women, of Black women in Mexico City. And if you look, there's a dot in every house. There's a dot in every block. Some of those houses were the houses where women work as domestic workers, but some of those houses were houses owned by Black women. One of the cases that I deal with Chapter 2 is an event that took place at the house of a Black woman, Melchiora de Monterrey. And, it is called her house, and it is likely that it was her house, but her house was seen to have also been the meeting place of the Black community. And in one account, the viceroy says that that's where they did playing cards and drinking. But also what we see in the document is they're not gambling or drinking. They're eating and dancing. That's what we see in a document that is accusatory. It tells us they had a great banquet and that they dance a great deal, right? So we have we can focus on three things about life, Black lives in this time in Mexico City. the labor, right? Blacks were involved in a lot of the labor. They were coach riders. They were, you know, bricklayers. They were involving all the trades. Some were artisans, some were artists, silversmiths, goldsmiths. They were involved in all the trades. Then you have the confraternities, so that in Mexico City, you have 10 confraternities, which is about the same number of black confraternities you had in 18th century Salvador, when Salvador was one of the largest black city in the world, right? So you have here a comparable, right? Less, way less black people, but the same number of black confraternities are there, serving important social and cultural ends. And then you have the gathering for the confraternal life, the electing of kings and queens, the celebration of the big holidays, and the eating and drinking, so the feasting, right? Which will be part of both Christmas, Easter, but also if there's a funeral, as you know, in black culture, it's also accompanied by feasting. So it's a vibrant, it's a very vibrant black community and life that is going on in Mexico City, especially at this time. And if you go to colonial museums and you look at paintings of the squares, right, or cast of paintings, or there's one paint, one series that is all the months, and about five of the months have black people engaged in different activities in Mexico City. So there were a large presence there.
Yeah, that's another thing that I really loved about the book, is how we engaged, again, just going back to the sources, with not only written sources, but your meticulous analysis of images, and your conversations about music and all that. So again, I can't tell people how much I love this book. But speaking of things I love, you probably have guessed that chapter 4 is my favorite chapter. I've been waiting for it for a while, since we talked about Queens of the South in Salvador a while ago. But can you describe to folks the performance that you're talking about in chapter 4, and why do you think it is so important? I'm interested here in also for you to discuss something that you mentioned here, that this performance marks the maturation of African Mexicans' Creole cultural consciousness. So I know I asked a lot. We can break it down if you want.
Yeah, well, no, but I mean, so yeah, so this text was one of the greatest find of the dissertation project. I mean, I did find it through someone had studied it, and I mentioned the person who had studied it, but I didn't agree, of course, with the reading of the text, because it was read from a different perspective, and they only had done like two pages on this text. So I I did, as you know, a long analysis of the text, of the poetry, of each performance that is relevant to the analysis there going on. I just found the performances themselves and the language fascinating, and even in this text, you can see how ephrastic all the description of performances are. That's why I found visual culture very helpful to do this work, because the texts themselves are very visual. But for listeners, to describe the performance is 12 black women in Mexico City who perform for the incoming viceroy as the Queen of Sheba, of course, the Queen of the South. In the gospel and all the implications. People may be watching the Queen of the South in Telemundo. So, you know, a long tradition, right? A long connection. But the women choose this performance, and there are African things in the performance. So at one point, they incense the viceroy with incense. The performance that led me to make that assertion about this marks that Afro-Creole Mexican culture has come of age is a performance where the women or the symbolic language of the performance is the women are roses in a desert, and the viceroy is the eagle looking over the women. Of course, here this is full of Mexican symbology. You have the roses, the Virgin of Guadalupe appear among roses. Of course, the eagle, Mexica, the Mexica pass of the Aztec world, and the viceroy is the eagle. Of course, the eagle represents Spanish power, but it also represents, right? So that in this moment, the women declare themselves Mexican, not even Afro-Mexican, just Mexican, plain and simple. And then the last performance has that phrase that became the epigraph of the book, Carbón con alma viviré a la fama, right? This coal with a soul, I will live in fame. So I also read that as a consciousness of that Blacks were entering the archive, the written record, the permanent record through this performance consciously, that they wanted to enter the permanent archive in this light. And it is absolutely important and symbolic that this is performed by women exclusively, whereas the performance I study in Chapter 2 is performed by men exclusively, because women were the ones who had more freedom, more leadership roles in Black communities, just because of the way Black colonial society worked, whereas that, colonial authorities were afraid of Black bodies, and therefore there was more control and oversight of men, and women had more freedom. And as I said, Melchora de Melchor was the owner of this house, tavern, if you will, where the Black community met. Women owned more, had more property. So even if you think of the economics of the festival, women had more capital to stage this performance. It is also the only of the texts that I found of performance that happens before the viceroy. So that we know that every time you had a viceroy, you had great festivities. And we know that Blacks regularly participated in those festivities. But this is the only text that gives account of that. So it's an important text that encapsulates everything that had come in the previous chapters.
As I said, I'm in love with that chapter. I don't know what I'm going to teach next, but I will find a way of assigning this. I just, But one thing that you highlight a lot in that chapter, but that's, relevant to the whole book, is your insistence in reclaiming the women's agency. And you mentioned, right, you had seen other works that looked at the source through a different perspective. And you are looking at these sources through an Afrocentric perspective. Tell me about agency. Why is it important for you to reclaim that agency? And why should we be reclaiming that agency when we analyze similar sources, wherever our researches might lead us?
Right. So as I said, that and you mentioned, that texts have been read and different conclusions had been arrived. One of the conclusions was that the women don't show any power in the whole performance. But that is just, I don't know how you can come to that conclusion. But if you look at the performance and you see what the women are doing, right, you see the agency. But also here and in the book, I'm thinking of agency as an avenue to investigate Black subjectivities, right? What is being expressed to these agencies, right? What subjectivities are being expressed, right? And one of the things that I talk about in the book, as you know, is this Afro-Creole consciousness, right? This localized awareness and strategic awareness of Blackness that the women so beautifully stage and the other performances study in the book. But also importantly to highlight that, if Chapter 3 shows, that perhaps men were sometimes, the leader of one performance, the women too, and were the leader of performance, and it's a very important performance also because it takes place in the throne room of the Virgil's palace, right? So all the other performances take place in what is today the Zócalo, right? The main square in Mexico City up to this day. But this takes place in the throne room. So it's in the heart of power, right? So the women are speaking power to power, right? So I found that very powerful and it attracted me a lot, that whole performance.
So we have, you know, chapter four with this amazing performance. But then in your conclusion, you ask, where did the Black Court go, right? You're talking here about an increased silence in the colonial sources about Afro-Mexican festive culture, and especially the tradition of festive kings and queens after 1640. Tell us a bit about you have some ideas here about why the reasons for this silence. And as an outsider here, I was wondering, why haven't these practices survived in Mexico, at least as visibly as they have in other parts of the diaspora? Again, I'm saying this as somebody from Bahia who studied Black festive kings and queens in the south of the United States.
Right. So, yeah, this was the great mystery that I dealt with in the conclusion. And the answer could be a joyous answer. The answer could be that they became so normal that no one needed to tell us anymore, right? Well, that happens every day. And this is one of the texts that I quote in the conclusion, says as much, says that this is a very usual and common thing among Afro-Mexicans, right? When it's talking about their confraternities and their fiestas, so that it became so common that it didn't need to be written about anymore. Why it hasn't survived, it has to do with how the history of Mexico would develop, especially in the 19th century, because a Black community was still large and present in Mexico City at the end of the 18th century. But then when you get the liberal state that outlawed the church, and then it did away with confraternities, right? So that, for example, confraternities have survived in Bahia, in Brazil, and are still everywhere in Brazil, and are still important sites of a Black agency in Brazil. That was taken away from Blacks in Mexico. And then that if you look at other places where this hasn't survived, it hasn't survived in Peru, it hasn't survived in Uruguay or Argentina, also countries that also took on this course of whiteness and later mestizaje, right? I mean, especially Mexico and Peru took on the discourse of mestizaje or indigeneity, so that Black culture got pushed to the side, right? So that you said you didn't think of Mexico City as a Black site, because when people think back Black Mexico today, they think Veracruz or Guerrero.
Oaxaca.
Right. Oaxaca or Guerrero. But because that's where our communities had freedom to continue being, right? Whereas in Mexico City, they had just been, they have just become part of the greater milieu, and the Black identity has been erased. So the Black culture has just been erased. That's not something that is continue. There's no continue discourse about Blackness in Mexico City. In Buenos Aires and Uruguay, they continue to the earliest 20th century, but then also got pushed to the side there. So, but that what we see in the after 1640 also is the beginning, right, of that, could also be read as the beginning of that erasure of Black culture from Mexican culture.
So I have so many other questions to ask you, but I'll let folks read your amazing book and learn a bit more about these fascinating performances. But before we go, would you mind sharing with us what you've been up to? What's your next project? I know a little bit about that because we met when you were doing some of your research, but can you share with our listeners what we can expect from you?
Yeah, so I'm working on my second book, which is looking at Black confraternities in Brazil. There are two chapters on festivals, which come towards the end of the book. But I think that the new research in terms of that book is looking at the churches they built as archive, as artistic expression. And also, I'm going to be thinking a lot about what does it mean to have your own space? So that we know that brotherhoods in Mexico and elsewhere in Spanish America and the Iberian Peninsula didn't have their own churches. They had altars or chapels inside convents or churches. But in Brazil, as you know, they had their own churches, and along with the plot that comes with the church, so that they had the church in many instances, the cemetery next to the church or the graveyard next to the church, and a little more space, right? Mm-hmm. And that also is key to how colonial culture, black culture, was able to survive and continue these traditions in Brazil, having their own space, right? So looking at spatial autonomy, spatial sovereignty, if you will, right? And the freedom to do within that space, things that you can do, that you have the freedom to do, to develop culturally, the artistic expression you're able to develop by having that autonomy.
Yes, and well, I'm already anxiously waiting for that as well. And just a bit of shameless self-promotion. We are collaborating on a special issue for the Journal of Festive Studies. Would you mind talking a little bit about that? And so that we can invite people, maybe somebody who's listening to this who might want to contribute to it.
Yes, please do. So first of all, the Journal of Festive Study is the first journal dedicated to festive study. It's a great and important new journal, now going into a fourth issue, led now by Isabel. And so for the sixth issue it is that we're doing?
Seventh.
Seventh issue. We're going to be looking at different forms of decolonial joy. And so we have some scholar lineup, but we're going to doing it not only scholarly, so creative work, videos, music, all course of experimental work are welcome to think, to help us think, and to think with us the colonial joy. So if you're working on something along those lines, you can contact me. We might organize a panel or two for the meeting of the American Study Association in Montreal next year, and the collaborators who will be in conversation leading up to the issue itself.
Yes, and we'll have a call for papers out soon. So we check out the Journal of Festive Studies website and social media, and we look forward to receiving your work, and I look forward to continuing this collaboration with you. It's always an immense pleasure to spend some time with you, my friend. And thank you so much for taking your time. I know you're a busy man. You've been traveling a lot with the book. You have all sorts of personal stuff going on too. And so thank you so much.
No, thank you so much for reading the book so attentively. For your great questions and friendship. And I look forward to more conversation, as you said, in sunny places with great food.
Okay, and to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. I just spoke with Dr. Miguel Valerio about Sovereign Joy, Afro-Mexican Kings and Queens, 1539 to 1640. It was published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. Check it out. It's an amazing book. I'm Isabel Machado, and until next time.